You may proceed.
Your Honor, may it please the court, Brian Jividen on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Jesus Jimenez. In this habeas appeal over equitable tolling, the government does not contest that Mr. Jimenez was subject to extraordinary circumstances for more than 7 months of the one-year limitations period. That leaves just two issues in this case. The first is whether those concededly extraordinary circumstances caused Mr. Jimenez to miss his filing deadline. The second is whether a later set of circumstances, what I'll refer to for shorthand as the post-writ circumstances, are properly considered as part of the extraordinary circumstances in this case. I'll begin by addressing that second question first and establish why the post-writ circumstances should be considered part of the extraordinary circumstances in this case, and then I'll return to the first question about causation. The context leading up to post-writ circumstances is critical in understanding why they should be properly considered part of the extraordinary circumstances. 7 months of Mr. Jimenez's clock had been burned up by previous extraordinary circumstances, and by the time the state writ had been filed, only 43 days were left on his habeas limitations clock. His state writ counsel, who prepared his 1107 and filed it with a state court, was under a duty under the Texas Rules of Professional Conduct to wrap up his representation in a timely fashion by both giving Mr. Jimenez timely notice and providing him with his files in a timely fashion. The Rules of Professional Conduct say he was to take steps to the extent reasonably practicable to protect his client's interests. Yet it wasn't until the 41st day of the 43 days that were left that Mr. Jimenez received his file in order to begin preparing his federal habeas petition. Indeed, it wasn't even 26 days until Mr. Jimenez's previous counsel had informed him that the state writ had been denied. Those types of delays, in the abstract and in other circumstances, may seem like a short amount of time, but with what was at stake and with what little time Mr. Jimenez had, they rose to the level of extraordinary circumstances. They bore the badges of what have been permitted to be considered extraordinary circumstances in other circumstances, which was they were external to Mr. Jimenez, and they were something that he could not overcome himself in order to timely file. Those circumstances were capped off with the fact that Mr. Jimenez was subject to a research restriction that only permitted him to research three cases, to have three cases on three different days of the week. So though there were 2 days remaining on his limitations period when he received his files back, he could look at literally just three cases before he was to file that.
I guess he had his state writ, I guess, the state writ and the denial, he had all those papers.
On the 41st day, he did. He didn't have them previous to that date. So when he received them on that date, he still had an independent duty as someone who's going to be filing with the court to make sure that he wasn't raising any frivolous arguments and also to vet those cases to make sure that they were still good law. A state writ had been filed a few years before, involved mainly state law cases. He had to raise other federal issues in order to properly create a federal...
He couldn't raise anything other than what had been raised in the state writ, I take it.
He couldn't, but he still had to be able to make sure that the case law he was citing was still valid case law, and he also needed to tailor it to a federal court rather than to the Texas state court, which has different procedural standards.
Is that a factual error? The district court seemed to just say he was missing the whole file, however many volumes, not that he was missing the actual state court petition and opinion. Where's your record evidence that he was missing? I mean, those are the essential things, right? So is it his response to the state's dismissal that has that?
It is. Page 395 to 396 of the record, and it's also record excerpt 10, he indicates that he had no part of his file, and he specifically calls out his state writ, his 1107 that was filed, as something he didn't have but needed to have in order to file. And the district court opinion just misapprehends that fact. It's the only fact that the district court really addresses in its opinion, and it gets it wrong.
The state writ had been filed more than, I think, 3 years. I think it took about 3 years to get decided. So in those 3 years, the attorney hadn't, I mean, before filing it, you should consult with your attorney. Maybe there's a dispute there, but at least the allegation is that he never, in those 3 years, saw the actual filing in state court?
Your Honor, there's no indication in the record that he had had what was filed. In terms of what he needed to be doing during that time period, that goes to a causation question with the first set of extraordinary circumstances, whether or not those first the concededly extraordinary circumstances actually caused him to miss his filing deadline. The government's argued that because there was that time that the state writ was pending, that that breaks any sort of causal connection. He should have been doing things during that time to prepare his state writ. That argument is incorrect for one global reason and for three supporting reasons. The global reason is that Congress has embodied an intent to give prisoner petitioners an opportunity to rest and focus on their state writ while their state writ is pending. The limitations period is told under 2244D2 during the time that a state writ is pending. And none of that time shall be counted toward any period of limitation in the habeas statute. So Congress has an actual intent in the statute to give petitioners an opportunity to rest. And that makes sense for three reasons. First is because Congress has also required petitioners to tailor their federal petitions to the factual conclusions and legal opinions that are produced as a result of the state writ process. Without being able to see the resolution of that, Mr. Jimenez would be shadow boxing at best for figuring out what he needed to prepare in a federal habeas petition. The second reason that that intent by Congress makes sense is that it gives the petitioner and his counsel an opportunity to focus on the state writ proceedings. Rather than diverting their attention to the federal proceeding and having to fight battles on two fronts, Congress wants individuals to focus on what's happening in the state writ before they go to the federal court so that the state has the best opportunity to address those issues. And then finally, the other reason that Congress' intent makes sense is it matches, it comports with the guidance in Holland that for equitable tolling purposes, when we're looking at reasonable diligence, we look at reasonable diligence, not maximum feasible diligence. A petitioner does not have to create a petition for every iteration of the world that might happen in order to be considered reasonably diligent. So it makes sense for Mr. Jimenez to have waited till the end of that, till the point where his state writ was denied to actually begin his federal petition. And so there's no causal break as a result of the time that that was.
Was the state writ summarily denied? Was there anything of substance in the denial of the state writ?
No, it was summarily denied, Your Honor. The court had called for additional factual development at the trial court, but it ultimately summarily denied the writ. So in keeping with this causation, even if we assume that the post-writ circumstances were not extraordinary, that those aren't considered extraordinary circumstances, causation still existed. I've addressed why the state writ doesn't break the causal chain. The post-writ circumstances, you can see that Mr. Jimenez is being diligent the entire time. There's constant contact with his previous counsel. He works as soon as he can in order to get a good petition filed before the court. He tries to seek a motion for extension of time, even though he's unaware that that's something that he could not do at that time. So the post-writ circumstances, I don't think there's any real argument that he wasn't being reasonably diligent during that time.
He was very proactive.
Agreed, Your Honor. Then that leaves only the time period from the time that he discovered the previously extraordinary circumstances to the time the state writ was filed. That was a 3.5-month period of time. You can infer from the record that Mr. Jimenez took about 2 weeks to find counsel and that his counsel took 3 months to file the state writ. This is a state writ which Mr. Jimenez's previous, his original counsel, the ones who had misrepresented the circumstances to him, had said would take months for a person coming in behind him to just barely get caught up rather than to even actually produce the writ. So the 3.5-month time period seems very reasonable given the circumstances of the case and the fact that that was the first time that he began to work on it. So even if this court doesn't find that the post-writ circumstances are extraordinary, still reversal is still mandated because the first set of circumstances caused him to miss his filing deadline. I anticipate that the government will say that he should have filed a protective motion. In their response to our supplemental letter, they indicated that they cited Looking Bell v. Cockrell, which is a 2002 opinion from this court, in which the court indicated a petitioner could have filed a skeletal opinion or had enough time to file a skeletal opinion. The citation to Looking Bell overlooks the fact that the Supreme Court addressed protective petitions in Pace v. DiGuglielmo in 2005. So whatever the court thought about it in 2002 is irrelevant, since the Supreme Court limited the circumstances in which a person can file a protective petition after that. And even if this court does end up considering whether a protective petition should have been counted against Mr. Jimenez, I think that it's also fair for this court to address whether his motion for an extension of time that he filed before the deadline should have been treated as a protective petition. It had the same marks that a protective petition would have, which is that he indicated he wanted to challenge his state court conviction and that he needed more time to prepare something to file. So the government's raised this protective petition argument for the first time on appeal. If this court feels that it is relevant to the issue, I think that it ought to address whether his motion for extension of time should be counted as a protective petition.
You want to address the Holland and Maples issue? And so that's number one. And then two, if Holland is no longer good law on that point, can you still prevail?
So, yes, Your Honor. So I'll address that directly. I think as a matter of reading precedent, as a matter of reading Maples, and a matter of first principles, it makes sense that Holland is the controlling case over Maples. Holland goes to great lengths to distinguish procedural default cases. Maples is a procedural default case. Whatever Maples may have said about Holland, the Supreme Court's made absolutely clear that unless it explicitly overrules itself in something that isn't dicta, then this court is to follow the controlling case, which is, in this case, Holland. We still prevail, even if Holland is not good law, for two reasons. One is that, as the Seventh Circuit recognized in Socha, the case that we referenced in our supplemental letter, when a counsel is ending representation, the agency principles that illuminate, they did not address Maples, but it indicates that the agency relationship is severed, and so that you cannot attribute those actions of a previous counsel to his previous client. So this is a case where, with the post-writ circumstances, Holland still controls, and Maples, even if Maples controls, its reasoning is inapplicable here because there's no agency relationship following the end of the state writ representation. And then the other reason that even if Maples controls, we still deserve reversal is that Mr. Jimenez has raised at the very least a colorable claim of abandonment in that last period. The record indicates he made numerous requests to have his file sent to him. That hasn't been controverted by the government, and there's been no other evidence on it. That's at record site 396 and in excerpt 10. And so at the very minimum, the district court should have been holding a hearing to determine whether there was an effective abandonment in that last period. And again, even if this court doesn't consider the post-writ circumstances, this court can avoid the Holland-Maples issue altogether by just finding that the earlier concededly extraordinary circumstances caused the default. Even if those events were just typical routine events that happen in every case, that only strengthens the claim that there's causation here, because that means that the amount of time that a petitioner is going to need at the end of his, after a state writ is filed, is going to be fairly substantial. There's going to be, at least it appears on this record, about a month buffered in for a petitioner to be able to properly file his federal habeas petition. So for all those reasons, even if the Holland-Maples issue doesn't come out in our favor, which we believe it does, this needs to go back to the district court for additional issues. With that, if there are no further questions, I'll reserve my time.
All right. Thank you, counsel. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Eric White for the appellees. I'd like to begin by addressing a couple of things that came up in questioning. First, the issue of the district court's factual finding on Jimenez's access to his state writ. The district court did not find that Jimenez had the state writ in his possession at any particular time. What the district court said, and this is available at tab 3 of the appendix, that Jimenez should have had access to his state writ. And so that actually dovetails into our larger point about this, about the important lack of causation here. We say in our brief that attorney deception, attorney misstatements can constitute, this court has found, can constitute extraordinary circumstances. But importantly, the second part of that is that the petitioner has the burden to show that those extraordinary circumstances stood in his way and prevented a timely filing. This court has addressed this many times, most recently last year in United States versus Wheaton, where the court said that extraordinary circumstances that happened at the beginning of the period don't necessarily mean that that causes the actual missed filing deadline. In Fisher versus Johnson, this court dealt with a situation where there was still 6 months left before the filing deadline, before the federal habeas petition had to be filed. And importantly there, the court made clear that this causation issue is not just a matter of but-for causation. The court explicitly says that the extraordinary circumstances pointed to there, I believe it was 17 days of being hospitalized in a mental hospital, would have been outcome determinative. That is to say that the petition, when it was filed, was apparently filed less than 17 days after the deadline. But the court said that's not the issue when addressing the causation element of extraordinary circumstances. It really is whether it sort of incorporates the diligence aspect of the inquiry within the extraordinary circumstances by asking whether a reasonably diligent petitioner, despite the extraordinary circumstances, still could have met the deadline. And this is true in cases from other circuits too, and you know, there are lots of different sort of timelines mentioned. In Brown versus Shannon, which is discussed in the briefs, the Third Circuit said that the fact that there was nearly 1 month left before the deadline, that was enough time to I guess break sort of the causal chain. And in that case, you actually had the situation where the petitioner still had to file his state habeas petition. So the court there said you could do all of that within a month. And the court recognized, you know, maybe it's not the most comprehensive petition ever filed that you could do that, but they said that the petitioner could still file a basic pro se habeas petition by that deadline. And I think one important thing I would like the court to keep in mind here, and I have a couple record sites, the federal habeas petition that Jimenez filed in this case is available in the record from pages 7 to 20. If this court takes a look at that petition, it's the federal prisoner form. It looks like Jimenez typed on it, and I don't know, there's nothing really in the briefing about his access to typewriters and computers.
This is more than we usually get, though. I mean, it has those addendum pages.
It does have addendum pages, yes, yes. But it's not, I mean, I just wanted to, you know.
It's not a brief.
Make sure that, yes, yeah. And I think one thing, there's talk in the briefing about Jimenez's access to case law from the library. There are no cases cited in the federal habeas petition that Jimenez filed. There are no record sites included in there. I guess I should qualify the cases cited. One of the claims that he wanted to bring is a Brady claim, so it does reference Brady in the title of it, but there's no discussion of case law. That came a month later when Jimenez filed his memorandum of law in support of the habeas petition, which that isn't subject to the the deadline, and that wouldn't be a reason to equitably toll the deadline here. But one thing that's important to do as well is to, and I have another record site for you here, at page 6,728 of the record through page 6743, you can see the state writ that Jimenez filed. And if you compare that document to the federal habeas petition that Jimenez filed, you will find that they are virtually identical. I didn't do sort of a red line analysis, so there might be a word here and there in the substantive allegations that might be different, but basically line by line, the three substantive claims that Jimenez wants to bring in federal court, the discussion of them, every detail that's included in them, is the same as what was in the state court.
But doesn't that further his point that that's why he needed the state habeas? He no longer had a lawyer, so right, the lawyer did the state habeas. He wants to see the claims that he should be raising in federal habeas. He wanted to get the state habeas petition, which he's saying he didn't get until, what, 3 days before?
Yes, he does say that. One point on that, and I think this came up in questioning earlier, is that the record does indicate that Jimenez previously had access to these types of documents. He mentions in his March 3rd, 2014 letter to Ellison that he wanted, when he's referencing the stuff that he wanted, he said, you know, he had begun drafting a state brief for the state habeas petition, and he said he wanted that draft back. Which indicates that he was shuttling documents back and forth between himself and Ellison. It's not clear why he didn't make copies of this, whether he can make copies. All we know is the fact that he's filing all these other letters means he has some means of keeping documents. Also,
how does a means of keeping document equal access to a document? You started out saying there's some evidence that he had access to documents, and you ended up with his ability to, or capacity to keep documents. Tell me how that's connected.
Well, I mean that he, the citation of the record that I had where he asked for a document back, we're saying the reasonable inference is that implies he had that document at some point because he was asking for it back. So it implies that at one point he is working on materials for his state writ, sends them to his state habeas counsel, and now later on, now that the state his state writ was denied, he's asking for some documents back.
That would only suggest that he was asking for something back that he had worked on.
Yes, that's right. Yes, what I'm saying is it's.
That's different than asking for something that the lawyer may have filed, isn't it?
Well, it would. It gets at the same issues as the state writ. It's not clear. It is not clear from the record that Jimenez had the particular writ itself. One thing I think that we would point out.
Maybe we should send it back for a hearing on that.
We don't think that it's outcome determinative here because the burden is on the petitioner to establish extraordinary circumstances. One thing that came up in the questioning earlier that we'd like to talk just a bit more about is the fact that...
Well, your argument seems to be despite the extraordinary circumstances, he had enough time left.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
So now you're saying the burden is on him to establish extraordinary circumstances. You're not... So you're saying there weren't any extraordinary circumstances.
What we conceded in our brief is that attorney deception can constitute an extraordinary circumstance.
Right.
There is this broader issue. It's often abbreviated extraordinary circumstance, but it really is extraordinary circumstances that stood in the way and prevented a timely filing. So we never conceded the causation issue.
Is there anything in the record that indicates that he had communicated with the state court while the writ was pending?
There is nothing, I believe the record indicates that there was some type of evidentiary hearing held in the state court while the writ was pending.
I mean, did he ask the clerk of the state court to send him the writ, for example?
No, I don't believe there's anything in the record that indicates that. And certainly, I get nothing that he has pointed to in the briefing or in anything else that suggests that he did this. And I think that is an important issue that, you know, we're talking about 2 weeks here, 30 days here, and that one thing, the state writ was pending for 960 days. And there is something notably absent in the petitioner's brief that in the timeline that he includes, which was incredibly helpful in the appendix, that there's just this moment where just over 2.5 years just kind of drops off the face of the earth. And it's not the case, although there is a tolling provision in AEDPA, and, you know, that is not time that is counted against his time to file a federal habeas petition. It is not the case that that time period is just can just be totally ignored. For instance, the Supreme Court in Holland looked to the actions in doing its case-specific inquiry to determine whether there were extraordinary circumstances that warranted equitable tolling. The court looked to actions that Holland took during the 3 years that his state writ was pending. It pointed to a succession of letters that he sent to his counsel urging him to make sure to preserve issues for his federal habeas petition. There are also other cases that have talked about the fact that it's not the case that work has to stop on the federal habeas petition while something is pending in state court, particularly for that long of amount of time. These practical concerns about having divided attention and things like that the opposing counsel raised might be seem more applicable to a scenario where a writ might be pending for a few months or something like that, but it seems very unlikely that in a period of over 2.5 years there was not time to take steps, knowing that there are only a few months remaining on the ability to file a timely federal habeas petition.
But isn't there the possibility that you could get the relief you're seeking in your state proceeding?
I'm sorry.
Isn't there a possibility that you could actually get the relief you're seeking in your state?
There is a possibility. I think
so. You should anticipate the loss and go ahead and file something.
It's not a matter of I don't think that you should anticipate the loss in the sense that you should necessarily when you have several months remaining in on your AEDPA clock, that you should necessarily file, for instance, a protective habeas petition during that time. But it doesn't mean that you can't be doing work asking for and receiving copies of your state writ so that you can be in a position where you can essentially copy and paste your state claims, which is what ended up happening here, just in at a slightly different time, maybe more at your
doesn't
leisure.
Doesn't that go to his diligence? I mean, I guess there is some overlap, especially on the causation of extraordinary circumstances and diligence, but the courts have treated those as separate inquiries, and here there was no diligence finding because the court found no extraordinary circumstances.
Yes, some of the factors would seem to apply to both. I mean, it seems like from the court's discussion in Wheaton and in Fisher, and if you look in particular at the Second Circuit's discussion of the causation element in Harper versus Ecole, it almost looks like what the causation element is doing is it's kind of an objective diligence analysis versus the more subjective diligence analysis that is sort of the separate diligence prong. That's I don't think any court has explicitly labeled it as such. That's how I've understood the difference. It really is, you go to the causation analysis when you have an extraordinary circumstance, whatever that is, and then you have to do, again, it is kind of like a diligence analysis within the extraordinary circumstances, because it's not enough. For instance, you might have a scenario where for the first week you could have attorney deception, or you could have a letter from the court clerk indicating a different time, and then it's corrected very quickly. Then you still have to analyze, well, could a petitioner have used the remaining 11 months, 11 and a half months, something like that, or the remaining month to file a petition? And you have lots of courts discussing those particular times. I want to briefly address, although I don't think there's a need to belabor it that much. There's a lot of talk in the briefing about how Holland requires this sort of this analysis that would sort of mash everything together to determine what's an extraordinary circumstance. And I think it is sometimes unclear in the briefing whether Jimenez is arguing that the attorney misstatements and deception is an extraordinary circumstance, and then that is somehow modified by or expanded by the actions of his state habeas counsel, or whether all of this together is an extraordinary circumstance. And he says essentially that the court has to take into account everything, even if they are otherwise garden variety negligence issues. A couple things on that. Holland doesn't really say that courts have to do that. Holland essentially reverses the 11th Circuit because it says it applied an overly rigid test because it had a couple categories it was trying to cram everything into, and said that, you know, if something is, it was a question of kind of gross negligence versus negligence. The Holland court did look at all of the factors related to what the attorney misconduct there, which made a bit more sense, because you have to keep in mind there are lots of things that can constitute extraordinary circumstances, only one of which is attorney, sort of egregious attorney error. In Holland, there was, Holland was represented by one lawyer during this time, and so essentially what they did was they looked at lots of things that in and of themselves may not have been, may not have risen to the level of an extraordinary circumstance. But they consider them together because they were addressing the issue of egregious attorney conduct, and they had one attorney, and so they could do that. Here, it would really be quite extraordinary to, under the rubric of egregious attorney conduct, elevate the 2-week or 9-day lags in response time from Mr. Jimenez's state habeas counsel to the level of egregious attorney misconduct solely because they're being considered part and parcel with or in combination with actions taken by Jimenez's separate state appellate counsel.
But shouldn't counsel be aware of the impending deadline? I mean, in other words, maybe waiting 10 days to send the files, not unreasonable if you've got 10 months to file, but when you're up against a really tight deadline, you better get that file to your client quick. I mean, it's not, I guess I don't see it so much as an issue that you look at all the extraordinary circumstances together, but you judge the appropriateness of the conduct given the constraints that were being faced.
Yes, I think that the difference, though, is that, for one thing, this court has held many times, there are myriad instances where attorneys should know the deadline is coming up, don't know the deadline is coming up for whatever reason, and miss the deadline, and it's an unfortunate thing when it happens, but it's not an extraordinary circumstance. And whether that's for agency reasons, because the attorney is charged with making those types of decisions on behalf of the petitioner, or for whatever else they are. I mean, this court has really made that. That's in an area of law where there is some lack of clarity. That is one of the few things that is quite clear from all the previous cases, that simply ignorance of the law or mistakes of law, whether it's by the petitioner's counsel or the petitioner proceeding pro se, do not rise to the level of an extraordinary circumstance constituting equitable tolling.
And we don't know whether the state writ counsel knew the deadlines or just dilly-dallied, do we? We don't know whether he didn't know when the deadline was or whether he, for whatever reason, dilly-dallied.
We don't know. There are references in the record. It seems like Jimenez knew there was a deadline, that he had a limited amount of time to file in federal court, but it appears he did not know when the deadline was. I mean, his counsel.
He said it wasn't extraordinary circumstances for counsel not to know the deadline.
Yes.
We don't know if that's what happened.
It is not clear. One thing to note is that in the briefing and in the record, Mr. Allison was hired to be Jimenez's state writ habeas counsel. And so there's nothing in the record that indicates any kind of conversation back and forth about this federal habeas petition deadline between Jimenez and Allison. I think at one point Jimenez asks Allison, when he's requesting the state documents back, he says he wants them back because he knows he has 30 days to file an appeal in federal court, which is wrong. And so there's no explicit reference to this deadline, and so it's not clear who knows what's going on. But again, I mean, this court has held multiple times that, you know, it's, I think that it would not be in line with case law to say that it is not an extraordinary circumstance warning equitable tolling if you have the wrong deadline in your head and then you miss it versus not being aware of the deadline or just not thinking about it at all and missing it. I mean, both of those fall under the same general category of, you know, it is negligent not to know the deadline and to ignore it, but not extraordinary. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, Jim. Rebuttal.
I'd like to make 4 points on rebuttal. First, the government has indicated that there was a lack of case sites in the application that Mr. Jimenez submitted to the as part of his federal petition. I think any judge, any lawyer knows that the amount of legal research and work you do on something is like an iceberg, where what you deliver to the court, the very tip of it is what's seen, and there's a whole breadth underneath that is that's done in the background that you don't see. And so I think that it's fair to assume that Mr. Jimenez was using that. There's also indications in the record he was doing legal research. It indicates at 396 of the record that he was shepherdizing materials to actually file his petition. So there's actual evidence that he's doing research in preparation for this. I also wanted to respond to counsel's invocation of Fisher, the case that sets out the causation standard for, connects reasonable diligence with the causation standard. The Fisher, the extraordinary circumstances in that case were a total of 17 days in the middle of the period, not, as here, more than 70% of the total time for the limitations period. So there's a very significant quantitative difference going on between the two cases. Counsel also indicated that in Holland, the court referenced what was going on during the state actions that the prisoner petitioner took during the pendency of his state writ. That is irrelevant to whether or not it needs to be considered, because an individual doing something during a state writ may show that they are being extraordinarily diligent, but that doesn't mean that it requires everyone else to be diligent in that fashion. Just because some prisoner did do something in a particular case doesn't mean it's required of all other prisoner petitioners. I think the last thing that last two things I like to do. One, the diligence and the causation overlap. To be frank, this is a mess in terms of how cases deal with this across the circuits within this circuit. I think that the Second and the Ninth Circuit have probably spoken about it most clearly, which is the reasonable diligence prong addresses what a petitioner was doing during the existence of the extraordinary circumstances, and the causation prong, or the diligence through filing causation, as the Ninth Circuit calls it, deals with what happens when the extraordinary circumstances have ceased. So that, if this court wants to provide analytical clarity to that, I think that that makes good sense as how to set it out. But again, that's by no means clear across existing precedent. And the last thing, in terms of Mr. Jimenez's diligence, this court has found that 2.5 months to file a federal habeas petition was reasonably diligent. They found that in Brown v. Johnson, which was cited in our supplemental letter. And then other courts, the Fifth Circuit has also found that spending about 1 month drafting a federal habeas petition was reasonably diligent, and that's about how much time Mr. Jimenez spent drafting his federal petition in this case. So there's ample precedent to draw on to find that he was being reasonably diligent during that last period of time. If there are no further questions, I respectfully request that this court reverse the district court's opinion. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement.